from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 2 years ago, the Deepwater Horizon oil disaster killed 11 and spewed masses of oil, followed by toxic cleanup chemicals, into the Gulf of Mexico. The future looked bleak for the environment and for BP. Now we're flooded with sunny images of a cleaned-up coast, but also trouble signs. And BP is riding high. This hour on Point, the Gulf environment and BP, 2 years after oil disaster. You can join the conversation. What's the reality here, 2 years on? Do we really know? And what about BP and the price it has and hasn't paid for disaster? What do you see? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A special welcome to listeners at WWNO in New Orleans. We're going to look at both BP and the environment of the Gulf in this hour. BP's been talking a lot about both at their annual meeting in London on April 12th. CEO, not the same CEO we saw 2 years ago, but this is new CEO Bob Dudley, addressed the Deepwater Horizon accident and the issue of trust in the company.
From the very beginning, we stepped up to our commitments to the communities in the region, and we've worked hard to deliver on those commitments now for nearly 2 years. Our guiding principle was not to do the minimum, as required by law, but to do the right thing. We've continued to devote people and resources to that area, and we are seeing recovery. The beaches are open, and 2011 was a great year for tourism. And independent studies have shown that the Gulf seafood is safe.
Looking hunky-dory at the BP annual meeting in London, where very good profit growth was also reported. We're going to look in at what's really going on here. Joining us now from the studios of WWNO in New Orleans is David Hammer, investigative reporter for the Times-Picayune. He led the newspaper's investigation of what went wrong with the Deepwater Horizon rig. David, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
And also with us from New Orleans is Aaron Viles, deputy director of the Gulf Restoration Network, which advocates for wildlife habitat protection in the Gulf. David, welcome back to you as well.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
David, step back with us for a second here, because, you know, for an awful lot of Americans, what they know about the Gulf is what they see in the ads on TV many, many, many evenings now from BP showing, you know, happy, smiling people on the beach. 2 years and a couple of days on now. How's it look to you? Are you back to something like where you were before? What's been regained? What seems lost or maybe even permanently lost here? How do you describe where the region has come to, David?
Well, you can't deny that a lot of the tourism is back, and that BP really did put a lot of money behind their words in terms of restoring tourism, funding advertising and stuff on behalf of the coastal states.
Which is great for the local economy.
Right, exactly. But then you have to separate out the way things look in terms of the environment. There are definitely still issues with the oil and a lot of uncertainty about how things are going to impact the environment going forward. There's a natural resources damage assessment process going on right now that could take a while, but will provide more clarity. And so it was interesting to go out last week, actually, with BP, with their COO, Mike Utzler, to look at some of the still oiled areas and to see them trying to come out ahead of the two-year anniversary with a little more balance to their statements about the way things look right now, actually in the environment and in the ecosystem.
Meaning it's not all so pristine.
And contrast that with the television ads that everybody's being inundated with.
Aaron, I want to come to you on that, but let me ask you about a couple of things, David. First, BP's drilling activity in the Gulf. I've been reading recently they've got 5 rigs drilling there now, the same number as before the accident, and plans to have 8 rigs in operation in the Gulf of Mexico by the end of this year. So they've not lost ground there. In fact, they're gaining ground, I guess, in drilling.
That's correct, and Utzler said it with pride last week that they're pushing forward, going forward with expansion, that they're dedicated to the Gulf because they're also catering to an audience here in the Gulf that cares about the way the industry is going forward. And this is an election year, and politics play into the issue of petroleum and energy policy, and a lot of that from a business standpoint is focused on expansion.
Let me ask you about compensation for residents along the Gulf Coast and those who make their living on the Gulf. Where does that stand at this point? Is that all wrapped up? Is it still in process? And what's the level of satisfaction with economic compensation for the impact of the disaster?
Well, it's most definitely not all wrapped up. The thing is, you can get a misperception a little bit about where that stands because there was a settlement recently. March 8th, the Gulf Coast Claims Facility that was set up with Ken Feinberg in an agreement between the Obama administration and BP to administer the claims payments came to an end. But the process continues because there's now a transition to a settlement that BP estimates will cost it another $7.8 billion. They've already paid out $8 billion in claims payments through the Feinberg process, and now there's going to be a new process that's governed by the terms of the settlement. And from all indications on paper, it looks like it's going to be slightly more beneficial to the claimants who have not been paid to date. Moving forward, that they're going to get, you know, multipliers added to their losses from 2010 that are stronger than what they had gotten under Feinberg slightly. But again, there's also a whole class of claimants that have not been covered by that settlement and will have to continue to negotiate with maybe a separate settlement with BP or continue on in the trial process.
So $8 billion in payouts, another $7.8 in restitution to businesses and residents, $14 billion I'm reading in cleanup and other costs since the accident. This was April 20th, 2010, of course. Close to about $30 billion for BP. And what about lawsuits going forward? Are there any criminal charges that are outstanding?
Well, there haven't been any indictments. Eric Holder, the attorney general, said, I believe it was last month, that we can expect something to come soon, but nobody knows exactly what that is. You know, BP set aside $41 billion to pay for these various costs. And from what I can tell, the biggest outstanding stuff is going to be criminal penalties, if and when they come, and then civil penalties, which are definitely going to come because there's pending litigation by the states, the local governments, and the federal government against BP, tied to some pretty stiff penalties per barrel spilled. And so the only question there really is going to be, is there going to be gross negligence found, which would add a high amount per barrel spilled to the fine, or will it be just a straight up discharge of oil, which would be a smaller fine?
So 4.9 billions of oil into the Gulf. They could be fined anything from 1,000 something to 4,000 plus per barrel. You're into billions and bigger billions in a hurry there. There's more we want to ask you, David Hammer, but Aaron Viles, I want to come to you on the environment because, again, the touchstone at this point for a lot of Americans is the public relations campaign put out there by BP. David says, yes, indeed, tourism has come back strongly, and I have no doubt that people have had a lot of fun on those beaches. But what about the environment beneath it? What's the situation there? We're looking at this report that came out from Al Jazeera, of all things, recently, talking about, you know, horribly mutated shrimp and fish oozing with sores and eyeless crabs and eyeless shrimp. What's going on, Aaron?
Well, the oil is certainly still here. BP acknowledges that, although the ads don't. The science continues to expose a lot of unseen impacts from the BP oil disaster. So we've got the oil showing up in the wetlands. We've seen very clearly that some of the most important habitat for pelicans, their rookeries, their mangrove rookeries, has been affected by BP's oil. And so they're eroding at a staggering rate, very frightening what that can do if you lose the habitat. The tarballs that are washing up on Dauphin Island and actually from Florida on through are filled with dangerous bacteria. And then they just keep showing up, the tarballs and the tar mats. So if you kind of pull together the scientific reports that are kind of coming out, trickling out, there's just a lot of concern. If you pull it all together and you look back, it seems like the oil's hit about every link of the food chain. We've got dead dolphins continuing to wash up in record numbers. It's an unusual mortality event that's continuing. Research recently released showed that the dolphins in the kind of most heavily impacted area, Barataria Bay, that they're extremely ill. We've got deep water corals that have been severely damaged. There's oil in the mesozooplankton, so the base of the food chain. And everything, you know, this charismatic megafauna, like fewer whale sharks being spotted in their traditional grounds. So it's not a positive picture. You got to look pretty closely, and nothing's collapsed. None of the commercial fisheries have collapsed, thankfully. but some very troubling sublethal impacts, things like the Gulf killifish that's showing developmental damage, heart development damage, gill development damage. So it doesn't kill the fish outright, but it makes them a lot weaker, a lot more susceptible to bacteria, viruses. And that, that is something where if you look at the best contrast we've got, which is the Exxon Valdez up in Alaska, the commercial herring fishery did not collapse in the first year or the second year. It took four seasons for that thing to commercially collapse, and it still hasn't come back. You know, they lost a killer whale pod. It's not come back. So, we're not out of the woods down here, and we have problems with, the glossy ads that BP puts out. I don't think they actually lie in those ads, but they just kind of paint a very pretty picture that ignores a lot of these worrisome signs. So
the water is open, they say. The seafood is safe. We'll look at that. This latest report quotes fishermen saying at the height of the white shrimp season, the last one in September, one of their friends caught 400 pounds of white shrimp, something like without eyes, just without eyes. It makes you think.
Very troubling. Very troubling. But I actually have heard from folks who said that statement and are a little concerned about how it was quoted. So I think those mutated eyes, the fish without eyes, that is, I don't want to say expected, but we know that oil, weathered oil especially, is a mutagen. So it is going to create mutations. Shrimp are an annual crop, so those mutations can quickly work through that food chain, and we're going to see things like shrimp with no eyes.
And maybe we get back to health on the other side of that. We want to come back and look at exactly that kind of nuance. Aaron Viles with the Gulf Restoration Network. Please stand by in New Orleans. David Hammer with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Listeners, you can join us. Have you been romping on the beaches of the Gulf Coast? What have you seen? Have you been out on the Gulf waters fishing, playing, researching? What have you seen? 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Gulf Coast environment and BP, 2 years after the Deepwater Horizon oil rig disaster. We all remember it. It was huge. It went on and on and on. Millions of barrels of oil into the Gulf, and of course, a lot of it up on the shores. Big questions about how safety was handled there and what the penalty should be for BP in the aftermath. We're going to look at all that this hour. BP putting out a big campaign to say, come on down, everything's fine. Here's another bit from, or a bit from that PR campaign with BP's General Manager of External Relations, that's PR, Iris Cross.
Thousands of environmental samples from across the Gulf have been analyzed by independent labs under the direction of the U.S. Coast Guard. I'm glad to report all beaches and waters are open for everyone to enjoy. And the economy is showing progress, with many areas on the Gulf Coast having their best tourism seasons in years. I was born here. I'm still here, and so is BP. We're committed to the Gulf. For everyone who loves it and everyone who calls it home.
Sounds great. And everybody wishes this region and its economy well, but we want to be very clear-eyed about what's actually gone on behind the sort of Madison Avenue view there. And no doubt people have had fun on those beaches, but we want to look closely at what's really there. Aaron Viles is with us this hour. He's Deputy Director of the Gulf Restoration Network. David Hammer is with us from the Times-Picayune, the newspaper that's followed and reported so much on the whole disaster in New Orleans, and you can join us. Have you seen the BP ads on TV where everything's great? Is that the reality? Have you read the reports of shrimp without eyes and fish with lesions, crabs with no claws? What do those tell you? And what about BP? Has it done enough, paid enough, felt the pain enough for what it did? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Has it paid enough to keep itself and others from getting into the same kind of problem again? We're going to look more closely at BP in a few minutes. But David and Aaron in New Orleans, stand by. We've got lots of callers here. Ian in Gloucester, Massachusetts, where they know something about fishing in the sea. Ian, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Really appreciate it. Great show. I'd like to build a little bit on what Aaron's saying. I run an organization called Ocean Alliance, and we've been working with the WISE Laboratory of Environmental and Genetic Toxicology at the University of Southern Maine. And we've been down in the Gulf for the last 2 years, working principally offshore. And, humans, I think, are a fascinating species. If we can see something, we care about it. And Aaron spoke to this. The reality is, rarely are species put at risk through sort of an animal mortality. You know what I mean? 50 birds die. That rarely threatens that population. What does tend to threaten populations are the chronic effects over time. And it's amazing to me, you know, when you look at the Exxon Valdez spill, 1.75 million gallons of oil, over 2 million gallons of dispersants were released in the Gulf. And, you know, not enough offshore research, as far as I'm concerned, seems to be going on where, you know, where the actual spill happened. I mean, we're doing it right now. It's costing us about $100,000 a month. And, you know, a lot of people are sort of out of sight, out of mind.
What are you finding, Ian, with your research? I mean, is it the pretty picture from the ads? Is it something else? Is it eyeless shrimp and, oh, my gosh, we're on the way to hell, or something in between?
Well, offshore, I mean, again, this will be the third year, so we're only 2 years into it. But the reality is it hasn't gone. I mean, no disrespect, you couldn't put 200 million gallons of honey in the Gulf and expect it to be all gone. You know what I mean? It's not gone. So there's still a lot of evidence of sediments. And the primary productive areas in the Gulf are sort of the top 100 feet and the top and the bottom, let's say, 50 feet. And there's clear evidence now there's still oil on the bottom of the Gulf. We are slowly working through our data with the sperm whales, and definitely we're finding elevated levels of a number of different metals. But I think another key thing, if you don't mind, is we're deeply worried by this strategy, the strategy of massive dispersants use at depth and the surface is likely to become, you know, the future strategy for all such incidents.
Because it gets it out of mind, out of sight, out of mind in a hurry. Bust it up. Move it around.
That's right. And, you know, I have to say, I mean, you know, come on. You speak to Aaron's comments there. We just said, you know, 15 years later, we're finding all these sorts of effects. This is year three. Ocean Alliance and USM are returning to the Gulf in year three. And do I have a smoking gun? I don't think we have a smoking gun, but I think the smoking gun is like it's almost like the out of sight, out of mind. I mean, there is clearly enough evidence here to suggest that all is not well. More research needs to be done. And let's not deny this.
Ian, I'm glad you're on the case. Keep those boats on the water and let us know what you find. Aaron Viles, I'm reading here again. This is from Al Jazeera. I mean, funny to have a Qatar-owned organization on the Gulf talking about the effects of an oil spill. But you've raised questions about how things were quoted. Okay. But here they're quoting Dr. Andrew Whitehead. This is professor of biology, Louisiana State University, saying, "What we found is a very clear genome-wide signal, a very clear signal of exposure to the toxic components of oil." And he's saying it's coincided with the timing of the problems down there. They quote Keith Ladner, third-generation seafood processor in Hancock County, Mississippi, saying the shrimp are immune-compromised. We're finding shrimps with tumors on their heads and seeing this every day. I mean, something like 40% of the seafood caught in the continental U.S. comes from this region, Aaron. And again, we wish the people in that industry in the Gulf well, but what can we say about the facts of the safety? We hear BP saying it's safe, you know, gobble up. How about it, Aaron?
Right. I think the safety issue is different than mutations and no-eyed shrimp.
Okay.
It seems odd, but it is certainly something where a level of a PAH or a polycyclical aromatic hydrocarbon.
This is the dispersant chemical, or?
No, this is in the oil.
Okay.
The kind of mutagenic properties of that oil, it's at an incredibly, incredibly low rate. If you actually looked at what Andrew Whitehurst at LSU was finding, those concentrations were incredibly low. That said, they're affecting the ability of this fish to develop appropriately. Historically, these things are they're even if they're low in concentration, they can very much affect the reproduction of the fish. So, does that mean it affects its ability to be safe for consumption? NOAA and, you know, FDA would say no, because they're actually testing the flesh of the fish, the things that we eat, and their tests have come up uniformly that things are safe. So the two don't – it's not like one's against the other. They can both be absolutely true. It's just the public perception that I think really gets at, you know, why we're seeing, you know, this concern and this very, very incredible response to the Al Jazeera article. It was the first one to really pull together that all these different researchers were finding different things that were a little bit troubling, and that the coastal communities are certainly finding things in the fisheries themselves that makes them very nervous.
David Hammer,
because they've never seen this before.
Yeah, and we're hearing that. David Hammer, you're there with the newspaper. You've reported on this from the very beginning. What about, as we sort of listen, you know, the rest of the country, the world, listen to what's coming out of the Gulf, what about the candidness of what's coming out? I mean, we made some calls around for people to be guests on this show, and we found some hesitation in the sense that there's a lot of pressure to sort of say the right thing. You know, everything's cool publicly. Do you have any sense of that, David?
Well, that is definitely true that there's a limitation on the number of scientists that are willing to speak out at this point. And a lot of that is tied to the natural resources damage assessment process, which is a very involved process that takes a long time. And the problem that I would say about the Al Jazeera report is that these are anecdotal findings, but they are by scientists, but they haven't been peer reviewed yet. But I would say that the things that stood out for me was the University of Louisiana Lafayette's Daryl Felder fears that microbes have mutated from consuming all the oil. And that's something that I can say Mike Utzler from BP acknowledges, that the microbes have BP's corporate line is the microbes have eaten all the oil.
This is the microbes that the Gulf is full of. What are the implications of that if it's true?
Right, and that's the point that Felder makes, and I think that's something that is a cause for concern, because if the microbes are mutating from eating all the oil and then they're attacking other species or causing damage to crabs and shrimp and such, then that's something that could really have an impact on the food chain. And that's the food chain issue is also reflected in the killifish issue, which is a species of fish, that small fish that swim in the marshlands that are so rich, such a rich environment for fisheries. And they're kind of the canary in the mine, as my colleague Bob Marshall says, of the Gulf of Mexico. So if LSU is finding mutations there and there are issues there, that could have a much more lasting impact on the ecology. And that's what's going to hurt fisheries and, the economy down the line, because our economy is so tied to seafood.
I mean, we hope not. And again, we wish that industry well, but we want to be eyes wide open here. The Al Jazeera report, take it with a grain of salt. You can read it at our website, but it's talking about fish without covers on their gills, others with large pink masses hanging off their eyes and gills. But Aaron Viles points out that doesn't mean necessarily that the flesh of the fish, what you're eating, isn't safe. I don't know. New Orleans, let's go to our listeners. Ricardo's calling from New Orleans. Ricardo, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
It was 2 years ago, the first day of Jazz Fest, that I was sitting outside, and I got the wind was blowing out of the southeast, and got a strong whiff of petroleum coming up. But what really has upset me is this "say the right thing" thing. Terry Troncal's editorial in the Times-Picayune the other morning that read, "Let's have a shrimp boil," just upset me to no end. It was disregard the science. Let's just go on like we have in Louisiana, as it's always been. And it's not as it's always been.
How,
if you look at the production of the oyster bits, which are the primary filters in the Gulf, it is not right.
Are you eating oysters down there yet, Ricardo?
Very selectively. I'm getting them from western Louisiana when I do eat them.
And a little whiff of petroleum still coming up off the Gulf. Ricardo, I appreciate your call. David, there's a critical note for a column in your paper, I guess. Let's have a shrimp boil. What about that, David? Is that the paper's official editorial position?
I think it was a monologue, if I remember correctly, who happened to be written by our editorial editor. Mm-hmm. But it's tough because this is part of the culture down here. I mean, let's have a shrimp boil. That is something that neighbors do here, and that whole communities get together around
a
shrimp boil. So, and I'm from here. I love oysters. I can't stop eating them. So, and I don't look for them to come from western Louisiana. I trust the process to work to a certain extent. I mean, I verify, I check, I'm questioning because that's my job. But, you have to live your life. And there's a life to be lived around seafood here. And if you take the attitude that you can't live that life, then it's gonna hurt our culture here extensively, and I don't think that the majority of people look at it that way.
We get the outlook, and at the same time, the kind of potential tension there with the science of what's going on. That will take some time to play out. We're looking at the Gulf Coast, environment, and BP 2 years after the Deepwater Horizon oil rig disaster. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Take another call from New Orleans. April, thanks for calling, April. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you know?
Well, I just moved here from Atlanta in October, and what I'm noticing, I walk around, I don't drive, I bike, and I walk because I don't like to consume oil. And the amount of anti-BP stickers on the backs of cars and trucks and SUVs is amazingly ironic and hypocritical, and I don't think that they really are catching on to that. And I don't think they want to admit that they're just as much of the problem as the company itself, you know. And
why is it ironic, April? I mean, BP, you know, it was their rig out there, their operation. Why is it ironic if people are unhappy with them after this spill?
Well, if it wasn't BP, I think it would be any company. And wouldn't the result be to try to consume less oil in general? And I don't think it's about environment. I think it's about their money that's being hurt. I mean, these people, it feels like they'll scrape the bottom of the ocean to throw a shrimp at a tourist as much as possible. It's not about the environment. It's about the money.
Let's look at BP. April, I appreciate your call from New Orleans. With us right now from San Francisco is Abram Lustgarten. His new book is Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. He's a reporter for ProPublica. His op-ed in the New York Times last Friday was headlined, A Stain That Won't Wash Away. Abram, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
How's BP doing 2 years after the big blowout?
Well, BP actually looks like it's doing better than ever. It recorded $24 billion in profits in 2011. That's nearly twice what it had in 2009. 2010, of course, it took a big loss related to the spill. But its annual revenues were up to $375 billion, a near record amount for the company.
What about its activity in the Gulf and beyond? Is it drilling as much as ever, and has it changed the way it drills, Abram?
Well, it is drilling as much as ever. It won a number of new leases in the Gulf with the last round of lease sales just a couple months ago, and it is actively pursuing new deepwater wells, both in the Gulf and elsewhere. And, you know, the company says that it's made big changes. Bob Dudley, its new CEO after the spill, says that he's realigned the company, created a new safety division that's reporting directly to the executive team. And really importantly, he says he's implemented a quote-unquote, a single operating standard throughout the company's operations. And this has always been something that's plagued BP, is a little bit of chaos and different methods and different rules among its different businesses around the globe. So this kind of consistency should be a real positive step. But they also, you know, they sound very confident that the changes are behind them. Bob Dudley said recently in the annual shareholders meeting that, quote unquote, the changes have mostly been made. So he says he sort of charted a path forward, and now it takes some time to see their effect. But it does look like there's positive changes within the company. It's difficult to know the level of detail about how they actually drill, whether they've changed, say, their best practices or the way they would approach some of the poor decisions they made in drilling the Macondo well itself.
They've certainly put a lot of resources, Abram, into speaking to the rest of the country on behalf of the Gulf, saying, come on down, the water's fine.
Absolutely, and public relations has always been a strong point for BP. You know, they will invest heavily in affecting the public opinion. They always have invested heavily in the BP brand.
And that brand, I mean, it's remarkable to think that 2 years ago, about this time, and in the months that followed, people were talking about BP potentially folding under the weight of this disaster, Abram.
Yes, incredible to remember that. I thought the same myself at the time, but that's certainly not the case. The company is a little bit smaller. It shed a lot of assets to pay for $40 billion in expenses related to the Gulf spill. But it's now starting to look purely from a business standpoint that sort of consolidation and refocusing is something that BP needed separate from the Gulf spill, and probably would have moved in this direction anyway. The company's as healthy as ever.
We're talking this hour about the Gulf Coast environment and BP 2 years after the Deepwater Horizon oil rig disaster. Abram Lustgarten, author of Run to Failure, please stand by there in San Francisco. David Hammer and Aaron Viles in New Orleans. Listeners, you can join us. What is the lesson of the Gulf disaster? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the Gulf Coast environment and BP 2 years after the Deepwater Horizon oil rig disaster. It was epic. 2 years on, lots of nice images on TV these days about the Gulf, people climbing out of a hole there, lots of compensation. Still more to come on that front and in the courts. David Hammer is with us from the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, investigative reporter there who's been all over this since the blowout 2 years ago, April 2010. Aaron Viles is with us, also from New Orleans, from the Gulf Restoration Network. They advocate habitat protection in the Gulf. And from San Francisco, Abram Lustgarten is with us. He's author of Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster, reporter for ProPublica. You can join the conversation this hour. What about the environment on the Gulf? What about BP? Has it done enough? With BP rolling on to hot new profits, will the lesson be learned in that company and others? And what is the lesson for all of us in the Gulf disaster? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Here's Bob Dudley, the CEO, American CEO now of BP, again at their April 12th annual meeting in London, where they had big profits to celebrate, talking about the Deepwater Horizon accident and improvements in safety procedures over the time since then.
Last year, there was continued progress. We had fewer days away from work injuries. We had fewer recordable injuries, fewer losses of primary containment, such as spills and leaks. But we are anything but complacent. Safety is a never-ending journey of learning, improvement, and it will always be good business.
Let's go to our listener, Zig in Boston. Zig, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I chaired the legal research task force for the Exxon Valdez Commission's recommendations 20 years ago. And
after the giant spill, Exxon spill in Alaska.
Giant spill. Mm-hmm. And my students got together again, and we did a series of legal research memos for the President's Commission on the Gulf. And the terrible thing was how familiar all the problems, all the failures looked. 20 years, we made 59 recommendations after the Exxon Valdez, and few of them ever got into law, and those that did were pretty much ignored.
What are the parallels that you see here, Zig?
Well, all the way in causation. In Alaska, we found that the problem was it was a mega system. It was too big, and it was characterized by a culture of complacency, collusion, and neglect.
You're talking about the drilling system, the oil drilling.
The entire system, drilling and also getting it to land. You have to look at it as the sum of its parts. And then the response planning was ludicrous, as it was in the Gulf of Mexico. And as Ian was talking about, dispersants have become the industry's favored response. David can tell you more about that.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, David. But,
hi, Professor. How are you?
It's out of sight, out of mind. Much of the oil never reached the surface because they had a pipe down at the wellhead pushing a great deal of dispersant into the plume,
right,
so it would never reach. But scientists tell us, and in Alaska, we recommended don't use Corexit and don't use dispersants unless there is no better alternative. The best place to get oil is on the surface, collecting it the way they do in the North Sea with big skimmers. But that costs more money to the industry, which has turned overwhelmingly to dispersants.
And you're saying don't use them because of their toxicity.
Their toxicity, and also because they break up the oil into little miscible dots that are in the water column. They may never reach the surface, but if they're on the surface, they sink, and that's where they do the massive killing that Ian was talking about to the ecosystem, which carries the shrimp industry, which carries the rest of the commercial fishery.
Sure.
It's out of sight, out of mind, but a great deal more destructive. And it really kills me. EPA just yesterday certified 17 more dispersants, including Corexit, for continued usage.
So what do you think? I mean, you've looked at Exxon Valdez. You've watched more knowingly than many of us as the Deepwater Horizon rig disaster unfolded. Now here we are 2 years later. What's the big message, Professor, you think Americans ought to be taking from this experience?
Well, the administration, first of all, tried science, but then the media was so hard on Obama that they turned to the optics. You cannot let science take a back seat. You've got to remember the lessons of the past. Citizens should be part of it. We recommended in Alaska that there be a citizens advisory council of fishermen and touring people, the ones who would be hurt the most. That was put into the federal law, but only for Alaska waters. The lobbyists killed it for the Gulf of Mexico. But there's no way they would have allowed drilling a mile deep without an environmental impact statement and no recovery plan if there were fishermen who had to be part of that decision. It's the whole system requires rethinking with a focus on the real social impacts. We're not even talking about the natural resources damages, the ecosystem services, which could be $1 trillion in losses that BP will not have to pay.
Zygmunt Plotter, who was right in the middle of Exxon Valdez and now watching very closely everything that's happened in the Gulf, Boston College. Thank you very much for calling, Professor Plotter.
You're welcome. Bye.
Let's get a perspective from New Orleans here again. Then I'll come to you on this, Abram, David, Aaron. Will in New Orleans. Thanks for calling, Will. You're on the air.
Yes. You know, I know a lot of people are on BP, and BP's tried to step up since billions of dollars. But the drilling that's actually done in the Gulf is actually done by independent drillers. Okay, BP goes out, this is the way they save money. They go out and find independent drillers, which they have actually put stricter restrictions on these drillers now to not try to do or cut corners like happened in that disaster. But some of these things, like your last caller is talking about, how a collection of fishermen and people that are impacted, the problem is people on that level don't understand the science behind it. I understand you want to get a council together to try to move it, but when you get people that aren't making the type of money that they see like BP making, they're going to try to supersede what they think instead of having a scientist that knows the environmental impact and says, okay, look, if you all do this, you're going to have to do this. Instead of fishermen going, well, y'all can't do that unless this goes to here or money goes to here. And they've done quite a bit, especially down here, and, you know, money given back and stuff like this.
Yep.
But, you know, here's the thing. Everyone keeps demonizing them, and I understand the outrage behind them, but aren't they trying to fix everything? And then with the money that just keeps coming, you know?
Hey, Will, let us pick it up right there, and I appreciate your call from New Orleans. Abram, let me come first to you on this one. I mean, here we just heard Professor Plotter say you may have $1 trillion worth of environmental damage in the Gulf that BP is never going to cover. But you're looking at the profits that they're making, which, you know, apart from they look small next to $1 trillion, they look big on any absolute scale. And what about the responsibility BP has really taken? Yes, they've pumped in billions, but how does the responsibility they've taken, by your lights, Abram, stack up to the damage that was caused?
Well, I mean, the costs that BP has assumed so far, upwards of $30 billion, probably going to climb somewhere north of $40 billion, is extraordinary by historical standards and even just, in the present moment. Mm-hmm. The company has clearly been active in beyond the PR standpoint in Gulf restoration and in paying its reparations. It seems like they're pretty engaged on that level, and I think that leaves us with, you know, this difficult issue of how the oil industry in general, or industry in general, externalizes environmental costs. It's not something that's wrapped into either our structure of revenues or royalties or our assumptions about what kind of responsibility society takes on. And by that, I mean, we need the oil. We use the oil. There are inherent environmental risks to drilling for it in the Gulf. And, clearly BP did a lot of things wrong. I think that where things should change the most course, is in their methodology for drilling. But the drilling in general brings risks, and society needs to bear some of those risks. And I think that's part of where you see multi-trillion dollar costs now. That is, and this is a funny thing for me to say, but that's the cost of doing business for the United States citizens.
I mean, if you want the oil, there's going to be risk attached to it.
Exactly.
David Hammer,
that's unavoidable.
David Hammer, what about drilling in the Gulf and how it has or has not changed since this disaster? Are there new procedures in place somehow that would lead you and others to confidently believe that this kind of accident should not happen again? Is it just endemic? What?
Well, I want to separate that question into two parts. Are there new safety rules? Yes. Are they substantial? Yes. Does it ensure that this will never happen again? Of course not. It's all about managing risk. It's about managing residual risk, which is something that we learned in New Orleans after the levees failed after Katrina. The problems that arose on the rig in this case were decisions that were made to add a little bit of risk to one decision and then making a separate decision without considering the risk that they added by adding the risk to the previous decision, and it just multiplied and multiplied. And when you look at these new safety rules, I did a story this past weekend about the way they've beefed up inspections of rigs. It's great to beef up inspections, but the question is really how has the culture changed within BP and other operators? Are they really going to have stop work authority where if somebody sees something wrong, they can really stop it without blowback? Are they really going to report every incident that they see to the regulators in Washington? Or are they going to say that some of them just aren't that significant and therefore not report them? And we definitely see those things coming out in the various testimony that followed the Deepwater Horizon incident. So the question is, has that culture changed? And that is something that's been questionable about BP going back to previous episodes like the Prudhoe Bay, Alaska pipeline issue in 2006, the Texas City refinery explosion that killed 15 in 2005. After each one, they say that that they've learned their lesson. And they say it again now, and we'll have to keep monitoring that.
We're looking at the Gulf Coast environment and BP 2 years after the Deepwater Horizon oil rig disaster. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to our caller, Edmundo, from Red Boiling Springs, Tennessee. Edmundo, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is Edmundo. I just wanted to make a couple of points that will probably create a difference in our world. The first thing is education. If we don't educate the majority of people about the reactions between chemistry, organic and inorganic, nobody will ever understand what is really happening with all the effects in the environment. Because the majority of people don't know a lot of things about science, chemistry.
Yeah, so you just watch a pretty ad on TV and it looks all right.
And that's right. And the other thing is that we have to, worldwide, we have to tax the main profits, the net profits of corporations that are creating all these problems. And due to the fact that the amount of people that don't have education, it is just the majority of the people, nobody knows, most of those people don't know what these big corporations are doing.
Of course.
Everything is entangled in education and taxation. Taxation for those people that create a problem, and education for those people that purchase from those who create the problem.
Edmo, that sounds like solid advice all the way down. Everybody's part of that cycle. As you say, they purchase and use, but we'd better understand what's going on here, and maybe taxation to cover the cost of the impact, if that can be done. One more, Dee in South Hadley, Massachusetts. Dee, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to expound on what Armando just said about the chemistry and organic chemistry, things that are going on in that respect. In the October 1st, 2011 New Scientist magazine, there was an article by Faris Jabbar concerning a scientist who's been doing research on microRNA in China. The scientist's name is Chen Yu Zhang of Nanjing University. He and his colleagues have been working with microRNA and especially plant microRNA, and they have shown that this microRNA survives cooking. It's not destroyed by cooking, and it survives in the digestive and the enzymes in the gut.
Dee, our time is short. Tie it to the Gulf, or does it tie to the Gulf?
It does, and because what this microRNA is doing is it's actually changing genetic cellular structure in the human body.
Dee, our time is short. I've got to cut it right there. But Aaron Viles, what about that? As people are listening here, you're talking about some genetic or some mutation implications that may roll through, let's say, the shrimp population quickly. Dee's pointing to what could be longer lasting things that move through the food chain. That includes us. What do you say, Aaron?
Well, we clearly need to be monitoring for the long term in the Gulf of Mexico. As an earlier caller pointed out, it's 23 years after the Exxon Valdez. They still are finding oil. It's still affecting the ecosystem. We're 2 years out here in the Gulf. We know that the oil is impacting the deep water corals. It's affecting the mangroves. It's affecting everything in between. To some question as to how extensive is that impact? How negative? We can't answer that yet. But if you look at the red snapper, the research done by Jim Cowan and then repeated out of FSU showing these increased incidence of lesions, very consistent with exposure to toxic oil, we know that the Gulf is suffering right now. We just need to make sure that we're paying very close attention and then not just letting the research accumulate, but we need to be acting on it. So we need to make sure that we're taking the proper steps to restore the ecosystem and to protect and increase its ability to be resilient, because the Gulf's been whacked before, right? Louisiana's losing a football field of wetlands every hour because of how we've managed the Mississippi River for flood control and for shipping, and then for how the oil companies have dredged thousands of miles through the coast. So it's not a healthy ecosystem that this oil disaster is happening within. It's going to take all of us paying really close attention and minding that research as it comes up.
Well, we will try and continue to do that, sort out good developments and happy talk and elements of real concern all there at the same time on the Gulf. And we're grateful to the three of you for helping us look into that in this hour. Aaron Viles with the Gulf Restoration Network, thanks for joining us, Aaron.
Of course.
And David Hammer with the Times-Picayune joining us today from the studios of WWNO in New Orleans. David, thank you.
Thanks again, Tom.
Abram Lustgarten in San Francisco, author of Run to Failure. Thanks for joining us, Abram.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.